I'm Lee Foster. You're listening to Action, the No Bullshit podcast dedicated to the pursuit of acting excellence. Enjoy this episode. All right, on this episode, my guest is actor, director, producer, and coach Terry Knickerbocker. Terry has coached some incredible talent over the past 30 years, including Sam Rockwell, Boyd Holbrook, Natasha Lyonne, Leslie Bibb, Emmy Rossum, John Leguizamo, and many, many more. Recently, he's been working on the upcoming FX show, the biopic of Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon, Fosse Verdon, starring Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams. He also coached Sam on Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, for which he won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. Terry is a graduate of the Experimental Theater Wing at NYU, where he continues to be a member of the core faculty. Terry trained as an actor and a teacher with the renowned William Esper, and went on to teach at the William Esper Studio for 25 years. In 2015, he founded the Terry Knickerbocker Studio, a two-year Meisner Conservatory in Brooklyn, New York. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Lee. I'm honored and appreciate you making the time. It's great.
First of all, I'd like to express my condolences for the passing of William Esper.
Yeah, I'm still reeling for that. He died last Saturday at the end of January, and he was 86, so he had a good long time with all of us, but I could have used many more years of him, and he stays with me. I'm sad, but I'm mostly filled with a profound sense of gratitude for all the lessons that continue to be part of my everyday life, everything I do in the classroom, everything I do when I coach actors, how I feel about everything. So much comes from the fullness of Bill's wisdom and everything he imparted to me. So we lost a legend, and he leaves behind his work in the thousands of actors that he trained over the years.
I would like to start this interview by having you explain the basics of Meisner training. Many people who listen to this show are in the beginning stages of their acting career and may not be entirely familiar. They've probably all heard of it, but they don't quite know what it is. Could you just give the basics of it?
Sure. I have a question, Lee. Is swearing allowed?
Fuck, shit, ass.
Okay, great. I'll say that because there's a Meisner joke. So first of all, I'm a graduate of NYU, and I didn't have any Meisner training when I was there. They've since added it, but it wasn't there when I was a student there. And at the end of the day, nobody cares where you trained or what method you trained, because all the great acting methods, Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler, Grotowski, Uta Hagen, Meisner, Eric Morris, they all lead to the same thing, hopefully the same mountaintop, which is really good acting. And no one says to someone, you know what, I want to go see a movie with some good Meisner actors. So actually, it doesn't matter. I came to the work because after graduating from NYU, I found that I actually had very hit or miss work, because that training I got was very much based in scene study, which is a way so many acting techniques start. So my freshman year at NYU, I was doing Streetcar Named Desire. And that to me would be like starting piano lessons with a Chopin concerto or ballet lessons with Swan Lake. It makes no sense. But I didn't know that, because that's just what we were doing. And so I had the opportunity to work backstage on a show with a guy who happened to be a Meisner actor, but I just know he was amazing. He was consistent. Every show he did, it was like watching an Olympic gymnast, right? Just sticking it on every single vault, every single thing they did. And so I said, wow, man, I want to do that. I want to be that consistent. And he told me about his teacher, who was Bill Esper. So after graduating from NYU, like a year later, I graduated in 1983, I started training with Bill. The basics of Meisner training go with the idea that acting is doing, that the essence of acting is doing and doing truthfully under imaginary circumstances. So it's not about feeling. It's not about going on stage to have emotion. It's going on stage to do truthfully, whether that's a physical action like tying your shoes, or whether that's an interpersonal action like what I'm doing now, which is explaining to you, or whether that's an interaction, like trying to remember where I parked my car in the parking lot. That if you really do what the character's doing and you understand who the character is, you're well on your way to starting to create a performance. It starts, and I'll tell you the reason I asked about swearing in a second. It starts with a really basic thing called the repetition exercise. Now, Meisner, in addition to being a wonderful man of the theater and a member of the group theater, along with Strasberg and Clifford Odets and Stella Adler and all the giants who are our artistic ancestors, was also a pianist. And he understood the value of scales, that a pianist, a guitarist, a violinist needs to do scales so much that it kind of stops being something they think about and becomes a habit, something in their muscle memory. And so he was trying to figure out what is the equivalent of scales for actors. And the first thing he said, well, we got to get rid of the text, because the text can often be very masking. And so we came up with this little baby exercise, which does a couple things. It starts out with two people, and one person faces the other and notices something that interests them that exists in that person, right? So I look at you in our little Skype screen, and I see you have a beard. So I might say, you have a beard. And then you'd say back to me, I have a beard. And I'd say back to you, you have a beard, right? And we go back and forth from that. And that little simple thing, which doesn't seem very profound, as Bill Esper used to say, it's not Chekhov, but it's the seed of Chekhov, because the oak tree sleeps in the acorn. And so this is not sophisticated, but it does a lot of things really well. First of all, it gets your attention off yourself. That's huge, right? Because a self-conscious actor is not a free actor. So by putting my attention on the other person, I start to free myself up to be spontaneous. And the rhythm of it is like ping pong. And ping pong is a game of impulses. It's not like chess, where you think about each move. And so by having that kind of bouncy ping pong game of the impulses, where I'm putting my attention on you, and then you're giving me something back, it doesn't stay static. It starts to grow. And little things might start to change. Maybe you'll say, okay, I have a beard. And you'll add the word okay. And I might say, whoa, where's the attitude? And by putting my attention on really listening, really doing that, doing truthfully that, not pretending to listen, which I pretend to listen, but I'm really listening to you, it starts to create an incredible intimacy, which is what actors do. They show up on set, they say, hi, I'm Bob, okay, I'm Sally, okay, let's do this fight scene, or let's do this love scene. And I've never met you before, but like basketball players who show up and start banging with each other, we're at it in a very intimate, contact-oriented way. The other thing we're doing is we're really answering. We're answering truthfully. So we're not into convention here. We're into what's really happening, what you're doing to me right now in this moment. And it also sets up the ability to work from unanticipated moment to unanticipated moment. So that's the beginning of it. Then we start to get into imaginary circumstances where we take an object and we figure out something we could do with that object that is difficult for us. So let's say maybe it's a mug that I broke, and in the imaginary world, I have to fix it. Why? Because it's worth something as part of a set. It's worth $30. And I say, why would I need $30? What's an imaginary reason that turns me on? So it can't be to pay my electric bill, because that's practical. But maybe there's a new Japanese restaurant that I'd love to go to. Or maybe there's this girl who's going to be at a party, and I have to be there because I'm smitten with her. Or maybe there's some half-price tickets to a new play that I'd love to go to. And so I start to get connected to and discover in the training what gets me going as an actor through the use of the imagination, which was a later phase of Stanislavski's work. When he first came to America, he was doing what's still called method acting, where your history was important. What happened to you when you were 7 that was dramatic or exciting? And then Stella Adler went over to France after he left America and said, hey, Konstantin Stanislavski, we're doing that emotional memory stuff of yours. He says, oh, I've moved on. Now I'm interested in the imagination. It's much more expansive. And Meisner was a devotee of that. So we're less interested in what could happen, what did happen, and more in what could happen, which means that you have a lot of possibilities. Because let's say you had a great childhood. How are you going to play someone who had a terrible childhood? Or let's say you had a terrible childhood. How are you going to play someone who had a great childhood? Let's say you're poor. How are you going to play someone who's rich, et cetera? So through all this what could be stuff, we start to play with that. Like, wow, if there was this girl that I was smitten with, yeah, I'd want to fix that cup. And so then we start to get connected to imaginary circumstances, which is a kind of alchemy. That's really important. That's basically what acting is. I take this script that was not written for me, and I turn it into something that seems like it was written for me. So I was the only person born to play this part by making it mine. And then we start to work with some scenes. And in the scene work, we have this idea in the beginning that any line can come out anyway. So we get away from obvious choices or line acting. So if a line is something like, I hate your guts, we don't have the idea that that's an angry line. We have the idea that that line will come out off whatever impulse my partner sends to me. So it could be funny, it could be silly, it could be embarrassing, and it could also be angry, but we don't predetermine that in the beginning. So we have a very flexible relationship to text, and we learn how to improvise with a text. And the whole first year, it's a two-year training, is all about really discovering through lots of imaginary circumstances and scene work, kind of what gets you going and how to improvise very freely and how to access all the different colors that live inside you authentically. And then the second year, Meisner used to say that the first year was about putting money in the bank and the second year was about learning to spend it wisely. And the second year is all about character work. So we take all those colors that you've unearthed about yourself and we start to use them in good material, good scenes, where we really start to become responsible to the material. And then we don't have this idea that any line can come out anyway, because you can't be in a Broadway show and have every night it be a different show. It should be the same every night, and then a little bit different because your partner's different and the audience is different, so there's that sense of improvisation and spontaneity, but the moments are the moments, and you've decided that already, guided by the playwright, and also by yourself as an artist. That's 2 years of work in about 5 minutes. So you can ask me anything you want about that, but that's kind of what it's about. Really doing. So one of the things Meisner actors are really good at is film and TV work because they stay fresh in every take and they know how to really be in contact with whoever their partner is. And that's a great thing.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense to me. Yeah, because you're doing essentially the same take and the same lines over and over and over again.
You are, but you're also being smart about what you're doing in the wide shot, what you're doing in the close-up, and you're also making sure that even though it's the same thing, you're feeling playful, right? And you're feeling open, and you don't have this rigid, locked-in idea of how it has to go. And if your partner all of a sudden raises their eyebrow because you're keyed into listening, you're going to go, whoa, what the hell was that? The joke, which has to do with swearing in this repetition exercise, because in the beginning, people get very angry in the work. Meisner wanted the actor to come to life, and through for him, where there was struggle, there was life. And so if you're doing this really hard thing and you really want to do it, that's going to set up a kind of frustration and upset and friction in you. And then you bring in a partner and they're sort of working off you and they say, you look very busy. I look very busy. I am very busy. And all this life is going on. So the joke is, you're wearing a tie. I'm wearing a tie. Fuck you. Right? Because sometimes an exercise just devolves to fuck you, fuck you. And that's kind of the cliche about Meisner. But if that happens, it happens organically.
Mm. I want to read a quote from one of your students, Sam Rockwell. And he says, I first took an acting class from Terry Knickerbocker more than 25 years ago. Since then, I've worked with him on every film and stage role I've ever done. Nobody's better at what he does. Terry is incredibly intuitive and full of ideas that are usually outside the box. His sense of what is truthful is like a laser. I depend on him. He's invaluable to me, and I don't know what I would do without him. When I read this, something jumped out to me, which was usually outside the box. And I was hoping you could talk about the importance of that, your thoughts on outside the box.
Sure. You know, that expression on the nose, or a cliche choice. And I would say that you're only as good as an actor as your ideas, right? And so you think about like Johnny Depp when he's playing Jack Sparrow and the story that he got the idea for that character. And that's a Disney movie from Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. This kind of loose, half drunk, reeling guy smoking a cigarette, you know, who's not a straight ahead pirate. He's kind of weird and he's kind of out of it and he's kind of playful, right? That's an idea. That comes from the actor. Or when Lee J. Cobb was playing the original Death of a Salesman, Willie Loman. He was a method actor, and method acting, among other things, pays a lot of attention to animal work. And so very typical for a method actor to go to the zoo looking for the animal. They don't know what the animal is, and they want to observe the animals. And of course, you're not going to see the literal animal up there, but they're going to take something of the animal's behavior and integrate it in a human way. And Lee J. Cobb was there all day and at the Central Park Zoo here in New York City. And he found this tired old elephant that for him just embodied the end of the line that happened for Willie Loman and Arthur Miller's classic play. And so we started to play with that and bring it in. And that was the part. That's an idea. That's outside the box that comes from the actor's imagination, because we're also artists. Because otherwise, why do repertoire? Why does a pianist, you know, play a Bach piece? It's already been done. You can get 500 recordings of it. And the only reason is because they think they have something to offer. Edward Albee, who wrote Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Goat and so many wonderful plays, Zoo Story, he could be a very mean fellow. At a rehearsal once, he said to an actor who read a scene of his, he said, "Well, you have just successfully read all my words. What's your contribution?" Right? And so outside the box is really an invitation to, what's your idea for this? Why did Philip Seymour Hoffman do Death of a Salesman? It had already been done, not only by Lee J. Cobb, but also Dustin Hoffman, Brian Dennehy. He did it because as an artist, which Phil Hoffman was a consummate artist, and he did that part, certainly not for the money, but because he had a passionate need to express something in his soul that had to do with his idea for the part. So we get playful, Sam and I, to go back to Sam. So when he did The Way, Way Back, which is a kind of a funny movie, at one point I said, "I don't know, what would it be like if you sang that thing?" He said, "You mean like as an exercise here?" I said, "No, really, when they say action, sing it." And he sang the line, and it's in the movie, and it's fun. When he did Three Billboards, we knew that that character's Achilles heel was his mother. He's a tough cop who's really a mama's boy. And so he's in a scene with Frances McDormand, who's kind of needling him about his mother. And I said, "What would happen if you stuttered every time you said her name?" And so he says, my mama, right? That's in the movie. It could come from anywhere. It could be a walk that you walk like a robot. I mean, it really has to do with your imagination. That the worst thing an actor can do is look at a scene and think, okay, I get what this scene's about, and then do that. Because what's your contribution? By the way, most film and television writing is pretty bad, right? It's rare that we get great words to say the way we do with great playwrights. It's very plot-oriented, right? And so you often, as an actor, have to turn shit into gold. And the only way to make that happen is with your ideas. So I was working with Sam this Saturday on this Fosse Verdon thing, which is a marathon. It's 8 episodes, 8 1-hour plus episodes. Episode 5, Bob Fosse has gotten out of the hospital and he's trying to make it back. He's won the Oscar. He's won the Tony. He's won the Emmy. And he's also a drug addict and a sex addict. And he's been in the hospital in the loony bin. And he's trying to get stuff back. He's broken up with Gwen Verdon, and he's now dating Anne Rankin, who is another dancer. Gwen Verdon comes with her new boyfriend to Neil to a house that Bob rents to kind of get things going. He's about to start on the movie Lenny, about Lenny Bruce, with Dustin Hoffman, because he has a need to prove himself that he's not just a musical comedy choreographer kind of guy. He's not just dance. He's a serious actor. By the way, Fosse studied with Meisner, which is interesting. And so there's a scene where Sam and Gwen have sex at the house. She's there with her boyfriend. He's there with his girlfriends. And at late at night, they have sex in like the living room. The next morning, Sam, Bob Fosse, is in bed with Anne Rankin. He finds out that she has been talking to Patty Chayefsky about his health, basically trying to keep him from doing projects. And I said, you know, think of it like be very friendly, but as if it's not nice to fool Bob. Like it has a kind of a friendly menace, right? Because it was really kind of a nothing scene on page. But all of a sudden it gave him something like, you know, I heard you were talking to Patty. no, that's okay. That's okay that you did that. Just, you know, and there's this like mafiosa quality to it right now, which is not on the page at all, but is something that excites Sam to play with. And so we just, you know, when we get together, it's like a playground. And those are the best actors is when I'm like, look, I don't know how it's supposed to go. What's fun? What's interesting? What gets my blood? Ooh, let's try it that way.
I realized recently that I did far, far better in auditions and booked many more things when I was proud of my work, when I was proud of the choices that I had made before going into the room. And I often went into the room thinking, this is not what they want, but this is what I want to do. And inevitably, right. Those are the ones that you book. I want to ask you a question. You talked about you're only as good as your ideas. Do you think that when casting directors talk about coming with a strong choice, which every actor on earth has heard, you know, forever and always, that's really what they're talking about, right?
I think that's what they're talking about. I think that they are in a bit of a bind because they have to sell their idea to network or whoever, and they're going to look at how many Instagram followers you have and chemistry and all that other kind of stuff. But you will excite a casting director when you do something that is valid, but not necessarily what the other 40 people before you are doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it's not to be different for the sake of being different, but it's not just to fall for the obvious choice. Say, okay, here's the obvious choice. I can do that. What else can I do?
Mm.
Things that the Meisner training does that sets you up for that is in the second year, we work on nursery rhymes like Little Jack Horner or Georgie Porgy, Pudding and Pie, or Hickory Dickory Dock. Now, those are nonsense texts, which you would never think of as being dramatic. And the assignment is, out of those 8 lines, create something that's valid acting and have 3 different equally valid interpretations. So, A, it treats you how to create moments, but also have to have other ideas, because nothing you make is precious. You know, you can come in with this great idea, an entrance, a walk, a moment, and the director says, you know, that's okay, but it's not what we're looking for. And the actor cannot get their feelings hurt. Just put that back in the vault. You'll use it for something else and be flexible, you know, mm-hmm. and say, okay, well, how about this? How about that? But yes, come in with choices, come in with your ideas. And hopefully when you say proud of your work, I think you're also saying that you like it.
Yes.
Like you're pleased with it, right?
Right.
Not just proud, but like, I get turned on. I love this moment. I love this thing. I love what I do with this line. I love how I'm treating this relationship.
I'm excited by it.
I made something and I love it. That kind of energy and enthusiasm and groundedness reads in a room. They go, okay, here's someone who knows what they're doing. And even if they're not right for the part, I'm going to keep them in my file. Because you're not really auditioning for the part, as they say. You're auditioning for the next part. Chances are you won't get the part, right? If 200 people are auditioning for a part, you have a 0.5% chance of getting it. But you'll make an impression. That happened with Sam. I talk about Sam so much because we've done everything together and he was the best man at my wedding and we're really good friends. But I also love his work and I love collaborating with him. We have an ease and a flow. He auditioned for Duncan Jones, who was David Bowie's son, for a project and didn't get it. Well, he moved on, but Duncan Jones didn't. And he was so impressed with Sam that he wrote Moon, which is an amazing movie. If people haven't seen it, they have to see it because it's a great acting thing. Sam basically plays a guy plus like 3 clones of himself. So he's got all these versions of the same guy, an astronaut named Sam Bell. And he wrote that part for Sam. And it's basically a one-person movie. I mean, Kevin Spacey plays a robot. He's got a voice. And there's another actress in it who plays his wife on video. But basically, it's Sam in almost every single thing out in space because of something he did 2 years earlier in a part he didn't get.
Hmm. Speaking of Sam, one of the listener questions that I have is from a longtime listener and friend of mine, Nelson Rithaller. This came in last minute. And I think that it's probably something that's going to be very interesting for everyone listening. We don't often get a whole lot of insight into what it is like to be someone at the level that Sam Rockwell is at. And he's won all sorts of awards. And here's what Nelson asks. He says, please ask him what the start to finish process of working with someone like Sam Rockwell is on a project. Script analysis, character development, etc. As soon as Sam signs on to a project and gets the script, what happens first? And then so on and so on. And I'm going to also preface that by saying, when someone's at that level, are they auditioning and getting straight offers?
It's 95% offers at this point. And so he says no to most things and has to be really in love with the idea of something, either because of the script or because who's in it or because who's directing it, or there's got to be something that really excites him, I think. And he would say that your greatest power that you have as an actor is to say no. But I would say even before he takes something, sometimes, many a time, Sam has sent me a script he's been offered saying, I'm not sure about this. What do you think? That happened with Vice, the Dick Cheney, Adam McKay thing that he plays George Bush in, because he wasn't, you know, he loves Adam McKay. He's a great director. And obviously Christian Bale would be fun to work on and George Bush. But we wanted to make sure that he wasn't just a goof show and that, you know, and so I didn't even get the whole script because they really have that script under wraps. But I did get Sam's scenes. We talked it through, and there's definitely some scripts that, and obviously he did it, and he's got another Oscar nomination for that. You know, it's a fun part. But there are other scripts he sent me. What do you think? And there are at least a couple I've said, do not work on that. It's a horrible script. It's an offensive script. Or he'll say, do you think I can score with this? Meaning, is there something I haven't done before? Something that's rich for me. So there's that. His process, he's usually well away, on the way to the process when we start talking. And then we'll just sit down. Sometimes we'll watch movies. We'll watch videos. We have to get into the world of the piece and of the character. So he was listening to the Bob Fosse biography on tape. He was watching Bob Fosse interviews. And he was watching him dance. He was reading interviews with Gwen Verdon, you know, really just getting into the world of the piece. And then we start to kind of gently read the script together and start to rough in an idea about it. And meanwhile, he's working on the dialect with Liz Himmelstein, who's his dialect coach. When we worked on a movie called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which was George Clooney's first directing piece, which was about, gosh, what's the name of the guy who did the Gong Show, who it was said was also perhaps a CIA agent. He also worked with some guys on like learning how to do some stuff with knives and guns and stuff like that. When he did Three Billboards, he did a ride along out in Missouri, even though it was filmed in North Carolina, with some cops just to get some stuff. And some of their dialogue got into the movie, like they call the jail the clank. And so that got in, and that's pretty tough because Martin McDonagh is a very tough guy in terms of his words. He thinks his words are great. But Sam got a few words in there. And sometimes we come up with dialogue when we're doing it. There are a couple lines we came up with that are in Vice. That's pretty typical. But we're just, the basic goal is, let's just make this clear and specific and interesting. And interesting not to the audience, but to Sam, right? And I think that's important. Can you make work that interests you? Process is different. When he did The Green Mile, which was like many years ago as a young actor, I had been listening to this old claw hammer banjo guy named Roscoe Holcomb from the Smithsonian thing. And Sam had a line in there that went, hey, fuckstick, right? That he said to someone, probably one of the guards. And I just said, Sam, why don't you start to clog like some Appalachian. We played the music. I played the banjo music. And he started to just build the character out of this idea of going, hey, fuckstick. Hey, you know, when he was dancing in my kitchen to that banjo music and turning that line, which seems menacing, into something that's more playful. So sometimes I just start to channel weird ideas and offer them to him, and he gets it. And what's great about him is he's so open to that. But really, we come in with a pretty blank slate. A very big thing for Sam is references to other movies. He's especially an expert on 70s era movies. So The Godfather, The French Connection, Kramer versus Kramer, which is the 80s. All those great movie actors from the 70s, Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, John Cazale, Meryl Streep, James Caan, Brando, and just like, what can we get from that? What can we, you know, we've used movies, we've recycled many movies, walks from movies, or when he was working on Moon, he was thinking of Dead Ringers, the Jeremy Irons film, which was about these twin gynecologists who are kind of evil, David Cronenberg film, and listening to Jeremy Irons' commentary on the director's cut of the DVD about what it was like to play twins. And that was really a big door in for him.
Fascinating. What are some common bad habits that you see actors develop?
Well, we were talking about this before we started the conversation, but a lot of actors want to get the easy way out. They want to take a shortcut. They're not willing. So they're a little bit, I don't like the word lazy, but I think they can get lazy and sloppy and general. And they settle for what we were talking about, Jen, sort of the obvious choice. And they don't really dig into the script and into themselves. So you have to be really great at script analysis and really ask yourself, why? Why is this scene here? What am I doing? What is the function? How does that link up in something that's alive in me? So I think they tend to take shortcuts, not dig deep enough. That's a big one. I don't think they work on themselves enough. I don't think they work on their bodies and their voices. And so they bring a limited instrument to the work, which is insane because they're competing with people who went to Yale and Juilliard and NYU who spent huge amounts of money to develop thoroughbred instruments. And if you have a squeaky voice, like you look at the guys who are on The Sopranos, which is maybe one of the greatest shows ever made. It's the 20th anniversary. But how many of those guys are working? There were a lot of New Jersey guys who got great roles for many years, did amazing work with that, but they got these accents. And what else are they doing? Now, I'm not talking about Edie Falco or James Gandolfini, who unfortunately has left us. Edie's a consummate actress. But there are at least 15 people on that show who you haven't heard from since because they didn't invest in themselves as actors. They probably don't even think of themselves as actors. So that's a big part. Just, I think, being lazy and not having fun with it and getting worried about their career. And my sense is if you do really good work, the career will take care of itself. If you keep putting work out there and let people know about it and care about your work, that's going to be your brand.
Related to that question, you've worked with, I'm sure, hundreds, maybe thousands of actors over many years, decades. You've seen some, I'm assuming, flame out quickly, and you've seen some go on to massive success at the top of their fields. Two questions. One question is, with the people who become massively successful, did you see it immediately? I mean, did you see it on the first day? And the other question is, with the people who become hugely successful, what are the traits that you see that they generally share?
I sometimes see it on the first day. Success and stardom is sometimes just about what's hot in the market. So I don't know if Dustin Hoffman would be successful now if he were just starting out. I don't know. So with Sam, yes. I saw him as a young 20-something actor in class, and there was something thrillingly free and irreverent about him that just made me want to look. Sam was fascinating, playful, emotional, a daredevil. And from the very first time that we worked together in class, and he was in Bill Esper's class, and I was substitute teaching a lot that year for Bill. So I got to work with Sam. He wasn't in my class. He was in Bill's class, along with a lot of really great actors. But I was just like, wow, that guy's great. And we started to work together. So he had something. Then there's a guy like Boyd Holbrook. Boyd, actually, you know, the second year of the Meisner training is by invitation. And Boyd's work was a little bit tangled up in his first year. He was very defensive and a bit sullen. There was something there, but a lot of it was just all knotted up. And I, in our meeting at the end of the year, said, I'm not going to invite you back right now. There's some work for you to do. And to Boyd's credit, he said, well, then let's repeat first year. I mean, a lot of actors, when you tell them that too, their pride gets in the way and they go, well, screw you. I don't need you anyway. And they go off in a huff. He's not the first person to repeat it first year. And he just immediately offered it, which was very humble and exciting for me. And he had a great first year the second time around. And that's when things really started to open up. What was that about? Well, he had a tricky persona. He had a tricky kind of emotional structure that made him very defended. And once he started to understand that he could kind of feel safe in the work and start to open up, then things really started to fly. So I didn't notice it at first, but once he sort of was there, by the way, I don't think when I was a freshman at NYU, anyone would remember my work. I didn't know who the hell I was yet. Sometimes people come in and they're red hot and you see it right away. And sometimes people need to grow and kind of find themselves in the work and they blossom. I've got this young woman, she's Russian. Her first year was not great. She was very out of touch. And just in the last month in second year, she's been really starting to get solid and her work is very captivating. And I'm interested in her all of a sudden because she's just ready now. She did some work on herself. She went to therapy. She decided to open up, you know, and so that's great. It doesn't have to be the first thing you see.
You know, it strikes me that some of the people that you've trained, people like Boyd, who for people who maybe can't put a face to that name, he was the star, one of the stars of Narcos, and he's gone on to do a bunch of other stuff now. And
Predator.
What's that?
He
yeah,
was in
Predator. Right.
He was in, not a great film, but he was the star of that, and he was also the bad guy in the last Wolverine movie.
Right.
Whatever that was. Yeah, that was great.
Right.
And he's funny too. He was in Skeleton Twins with Kristen Wiig.
That's right. Yeah. Is he Australian?
No, he's from Kentucky.
Okay. Yeah, because he played an Australian guy. Okay.
Yeah, he played an Australian diving instructor. He's really good at accents.
Thinking about these people, John Leguizamo, Emmy Rossum, Boyd, the list goes on, Sam, they all seem to share a quality that is they are just really, really interesting to watch. And I know that sounds trivial because obviously, of course they are, but I consider myself to be like, I've been a student of acting, especially film acting, since long before I ever considered being an actor, ever since I was a little kid. And there's just some people who are just more fun to watch than other people.
And that's true.
Yes.
But I bet that those so-called uninteresting people were more interesting when they were children. I just find most kids really, I mean, you have a question here about kids and nature and why I think that's important, but I have a 5-year-old son, and even now he's starting to get some defenses. Like, we're very affectionate at home, but if I bring him into the kindergarten class and I want to hug and kiss him in class, he gets embarrassed. And so it's the child in us that's doing the acting. And we start to worry about fitting in. We don't want to be bullied. We don't want to be made fun of. But if we could get the child when they're at their most free, when they're touching sand for the first time or eating a strawberry for the first time, right? That wonder that children have, I find endlessly captivating. And sure, there are kids who are more interesting than others, but basically most kids are really cool to watch. And so I think something in their freedom gets a little bit lost. And what those actors that you just mentioned have, and people like Chris Messina, who I love working with, has, is this like childlike wonder and devotion to play, that they see the work. They love storytelling. They love living out stories. They love having those experiences in their bodies and in their hearts. It's a joy for them to do that kind of play, to make believe. And some of the less interesting actors are what I'd call conventional. And they're a little stiff. And they're good for playing CEOs and stuff like that, but they're not very interesting CEOs.
I've heard you talk about you believe in the holistic view of the actor, and some of the people that you've trained talk about that. What does that mean?
This thing that we do with acting, we make it up out of our own bodies and our voices and our spirits. And so if you are a good actor, but you don't know who you are, or you don't know how your voice works, or you don't know how your spine works, I think you're limited. And so it's very typical for me to pay attention to everything that comes into the room. So if I have a talented actor, but they have a chronic throat issue, not only does it affect their voice, but it also signals that there's some issues with self-care there. Actors are weird, but the best actors are reliable and take care of their instrument, right? Because this is your instrument. It's like a Stradivarius violin. And so, for instance, when I first started acting, I was a smoker. A lot of people, most people smoke cigarettes than nowadays. And my acting teacher, the great Terry Hayden at Circle in the Square Theater School as part of NYU, said, "You're killing your instrument. How can you be a smoker and be an actor?" For a lot of reasons. First of all, it smells. Second of all, it costs money. Third of all, most people smoke and have oral habits because they're trying to suppress feelings. If there's anything we're trying to do, we're trying to open up our feelings, right? And it's a habit. None of that is a good idea for acting. None of that will make you a better actor. It'll make you feel cool, and actors like to feel cool, but it's not going to make you a better actor. It's like taking like a screw and attacking a guitar with it. Like, you'd never do that, right? So that just woke me up, and I quit smoking immediately. Even though I loved it, it was very comforting and all that, and you know, go to a bar and have a beer and smoke, because you could smoke in bars back then, but it wasn't helping me. And so I want to work with actors whose North Star is to be the best actor they can be. If that's true, then there are things to pay attention to. So maybe you need some acupuncture. You definitely need to be in therapy, right? Because unless you had perfect parents, you're fucked, right? And if you don't know why you do things, why was I late to that meeting? Why did I blow up at that guy at the restaurant? If you don't understand that about yourself, you can't use it for your work. Eric Clapton knows every single fret on his guitar. He knows how to make every single sound that that instrument can make. If you don't understand every nook and cranny of your body, your voice, and your psyche, it's not available to you. If you don't understand it, you can't act it. And so you have to understand yourself, and your study has to be mankind. So if you want to play someone who's jealous, you got to understand where jealousy lives in you, and you got to be open to that, right? If you're going to play someone who gets a broken heart, you got to know what makes your heart break. And I don't know of any other way to do that, to really learn about yourself in the deepest way, than to be in therapy. And to be in therapy for the rest of your life. I go every week, and I've done a lot of work on myself, but I'm still unpeeling the onion. And it helps me to be a better teacher and a better father and a better husband and a better artist. So I think that's important. I think you got to take care of yourself. You got to deal with whatever needs to be dealt with. So if you're late all the time, what the hell is that? Why are you late? How is that helping you? So to really pay attention to what's in the room and not just the acting itself.
Well, Terry, we're coming up on the end of our time. I want to get to a couple more things, and we didn't get to everything. And you know, you'll have to come back for another episode sometime in the future.
That's really nice of you. It's been easy to talk to you.
Well, it's been very easy to talk to you as well. Where can people find out more about you and connect with you and find out more about what it is you do, your school and everything?
Yeah, thank you. I have a school. It's in Brooklyn. It's a 2-year Meisner Conservatory, and we also have a summer session. It's on the web, terryknickerbockerstudio.com. Knickerbocker spelled like the basketball team. We're on Instagram, Facebook, all those kinds of places. And they're welcome to drop us a line and start a conversation, because all our classes are by interview. And that's something I got from Bill Esper, that like at NYU, you audition. You also have a conversation, but there's an audition. And for this training, sometimes people come in, you know, with monologues, and they've been coached within an inch of their lives, and it doesn't really tell us who they are. We don't do auditions. We do interviews, and we kind of want to know, what are your goals? What are you looking for? Why do you love to act? And how can we help? I'd love to anyone who loves to act is a friend of mine.
One question that I definitely want to ask you is, what is the number one thing that actors should remember when walking into an audition room?
I think they need a mantra that I got from my wonderful colleague, Maggie Flanagan, which is fuck it, right? That And it doesn't mean I don't care. It means I'm not going to be controlled by my anxiety. I'm going to come in. Why am I doing this in the first place? It has to do with that why that Simon Sinek talks about, that you start with why. Why am I doing this? Because I love acting, because I love to tell stories. So this is a day where I get to have a few moments. I'm not on trial. This is not a test of whether I have talent or not. They're not a firing squad. First of all, everyone in an audition room is dying for someone to come in and do it great. They're rooting for you because they need the part, right? So they're actually a friendly audience, even if they seem kind of jerky or remote or cynical. They actually want you to shine, because if you shine, that makes their job easy. So come in. Fuck it means I'm there to have fun. Let's rock and roll. I got some ideas. Let's throw down. This is my version of the part. If you like it, great. If not, it's a better day because I did some acting.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
If you like this podcast, please go to your podcast app, scroll down, and give me a rating or a review. Thank you for listening.